This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we are slated to talk some Louisiana politics and scheduled to have a visit from the Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana, Jay Darden, the pride of Baton Rouge High, who is the former Secretary of State, former State Senator, former Metro Council member, and one-time LSU student body president. We'll talk with Jay Darden about what's going to happen with him and with our state in the electoral season of this year and next, as all statewide offices are up for grabs. Also, Erica Crenshaw, President and CEO of Execute Now, on many of the challenges that nonprofits are having and the changing economic times. We'll talk with Erica about this and more. But now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. InksterShow@WRKF.org online. Our guest to begin is John Lee J. Darden, Jr., the Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana, the pride of Baton Rouge High, a man who's been around the political block many times in Louisiana, starting with the election to the LSU student body president's position back in the late 1970s. Since then, he's been a Metro Councilman, a state senator, Secretary of State, and now Lieutenant Governor since 2006. Actually, 2006 was when he was elected Secretary of State, became Lieutenant Governor in 2010. And now he is running for Governor of Louisiana in 2015. Why do you want to be Governor? Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Good to be with you. I've had a great opportunity to serve the people of Louisiana in the capacities you just mentioned, and the governor's office is a place where you can really shape the future of our state, and we need to have a vision for where we want to be in 25 years and try and take advantage of some of the lost opportunities we've had over the past decades in Louisiana, and I believe, and I think a lot of people in Louisiana who have encouraged me think I'm the person to do that.
You had a close call a few years ago on the roads, so we can relate to that, but how did that change you in any way?
No, it didn't. It certainly was a wake-up call, you know, and we both had serious accidents. I was very fortunate. I kind of had a phantom driver cut in front of me on the interstate and forced me to have to veer over, and I got clipped from behind and spun around like the house in the Wizard of Oz and hit a ditch and broke my pelvis and the lower part of my back, and it really was a wake-up call. I'd been very fortunate, not had any health problems for all my life. I was in my, I guess, mid-50s then, and so it was a wake-up call, but I'm very fortunate. No residual problems. I imagine I'll have some arthritis down the road, but I'm back to doing everything I enjoy doing except playing basketball. I haven't gone back to playing basketball since then.
Well, you look good. Certainly fit for a man of 60. That's hard to believe.
It really is hard to believe. That's a recent occurrence, but
as in February 6th. So that's relatively recent. As far as the issues that will be on the front burner next year when you're on the campaign trail running for governor, what do you think the primary issues are in our state right now?
I think a lot of things can change over the course of the next year, but clearly we're looking at tremendous industrial growth in Louisiana for the next 5 to 10 years. And I think everybody recognizes that managing what we hope is going to be the success of Louisiana from a business standpoint is going to be an issue. Making certain that we have a trained workforce, and I think this is the biggest issue looming ahead for Louisiana, is determining what we can do to prepare Louisianians to deal with the hopefully relatively high-paying jobs that are coming throughout Louisiana, particularly along the coast and in South Louisiana, where so much economic development is on the books. Not all of the projects will happen. We see things come and go, but I think you're going to see a huge growth spurt for Louisiana. I think preparing a workforce, training a workforce in short order, and thinking about what Louisiana is going to look like in the future and making certain that our K-12 educational system prepares the next generation of Louisianians for the kind of success we're going to have.
This is an interesting time, and we'll get into the field and the dynamics of the race. And Jay Darden, I think, was the first up. This is the ultimate goal for you. You're not looking to run for president of the United States or anything beyond this, are you?
No, I'm not. I've made it very clear. I love Louisiana. I love being in Louisiana. I had several opportunities to consider running for office that would potentially take me to Washington, and I really wasn't interested in doing that. I've never been interested in doing that, and certainly I'm not interested in any office beyond the one that I'll seek next year.
We mentioned, or I mentioned, higher education. You were student body president of LSU. Higher education has been cut significantly by the current governor, and there are only so many places to cut, but is this something that will be part of the Darden philosophy, or will you switch course?
Well, it'll be a huge, I guess, change, because I do think higher education has suffered under the problems we face budgetarily. Higher education in LSU will be a main priority for me. I think the rising tide lifts all ships, and Louisiana State University is the flagship university. It's undergone a lot of changes over the course of the past couple of years, trying to reshape its governance, and I think that bodes well. But I've been very involved with a number of the universities across the state, and higher education is a very important part of where we need to be from an educational standpoint. When I was president of the student body, and this goes back, you always like to talk about this, but back in the 70s, I remember writing a letter to the editor about the cuts that higher education was facing in the 70s. This has been a longstanding mm-hmm. issue. We finally got to full funding under the formula for higher education during the Foster years. We've retreated from that as a result of some of the budget challenges that have been with us, but there's some serious issues in higher education, loss of faculty members that are very hard to replace once the word is out that people are leaving and not coming to your institution.
Are there ways to protect higher education, to increase funding short of revenue enhancements, taxes?
Well, yeah, it won't be taxes, and I think most people recognize that's not necessarily the solution. Higher education is unprotected right now, and it has been for some period of time. I think you're going to see some discussion, and I'm going to be involved in this discussion with higher education leaders as what can be done. The legislature is, I think, probably very reluctant to give up the control it has on making budgetary decisions, but so much of our state budget is dedicated that the discussion always goes to, do you undedicate monies so that there's more discretion to the legislature? Do you have more dedicated money so there's less discretion? Higher education right now is about as unprotected as anybody, and it becomes the one that suffers in times of budget cuts.
297-5633 is your number, and we will go to the phone lines in just a bit for Jay Darden running for governor. And I think most political observers would say you're everybody's nightmare in a runoff, because I think you would get some crossover support from Democrats, and you would get a good portion of the Republican vote as a staunch Republican. But getting there is the issue in our open primary, and you're going to be challenged from the left and the right, it looks like. How do you get there?
You know, this has been the story of my various campaigns. There have always been efforts to squeeze me from both sides, and I've never seemed to have been the best funded candidate. I've never been the candidate who's had the full support of my party, but we've managed to succeed because I'm going to continue being who I am. I hope I'm the same person I was when I started in public office, and I'm not going to change for the sake of this election. And I've got a record, and people like to attack records. People like to talk about the great things in records, and I'm going to be who I am and let the people decide if the style I have and the way I've conducted myself, they believe is where Louisiana ought to go in the future. And I'm going to do my best to convince them that that's the case.
People may forget, but Jay Darden was in the state legislature as a senator when David Vitter was there as a state representative. He was a bomb thrower then, wasn't he?
He was. he absolutely was. A lot of us were bomb throwers at the time. You know, that was the Governor Edwards' last term. I was a new upstart mm-hmm. Republican, as was David and several other people, and we were certainly not on the team, as it were, back then.
And you came in together, didn't you?
We came in at the same time. You know, I was filing. If you go back and look at the bills I filed in that first term, I was filing ethics bills, many of which go well beyond where mm-hmm. we are right now in the changes in ethics laws. I can remember sitting in front of the Senate and Governmental Affairs Committee and being asked, do you want us to kill your bills all at once, or do you want to take them one at a time? And I said, I want to take them one at a time. We talked about them, and they all went down to defeat. But several of the concepts are now in Louisiana law and will be the topic of further discussion in Louisiana law.
But as I recall, I don't recall Senator Vitter, now then Representative Vitter, being particularly popular even in the Republican ranks.
Well, I think that's a fair characterization. There was, he was advancing his career in talking about problems with Republicans and Democrats, and that didn't necessarily endear him to some people. But that, you know, that's kind of the way it goes in politics.
But you two are not really cut of the same political cloth, are you?
Well, not really. We both certainly have been longstanding Republicans and will continue to be. I handle the term limits bill, for example, in the Senate for David. I think that's the only bill I handled that David had authored in the House, and that was a bill that came sailing out of the House because everybody was convinced it would die in the Senate. It would never have a chance, and I get the credit and the blame, I guess, for term limits or people who feel strongly on both sides, but I did get the bill passed in the Senate, and it was not expected to be the case. But, you know, there was a huge public uproar at that time in favor of term limits, and I think there still is support for the concept, even though there is some criticism of it. But there was really a great grassroots effort across this state at a time that people didn't think that would happen. And, of course, it started trying to put term limits on Congress. That's really where we need it. But that's never seemed to have gained much favor in Washington. But we were able to pass the bill in the Senate on the strength of my persistence and the grassroots support around the state that made it happen.
How important is it for a governor to be able to work with people? That's been a criticism of Senator Vitter and occasionally a criticism of the current governor.
You know, it's the key, in my view, to virtually anything in life. You have to be able to understand people, listen to people, get along with people. And that's a big part of what a governor has to do in communicating to the people of a state and to legislators. And certainly I was there for 15 years. I understand a legislator's perspective. I understand the governor's role in dealing with the legislature. And I understand the need for some degree of independence in the legislature in making its decisions. And I respect that. I came from that world, and I believe that's an important respect that a governor needs to give the legislature.
Bruce and Walden, we start with you, Bruce. Good morning. You're on with Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden.
Good morning. We have high hopes for you, Jay Darden. The question I have concerns a missed opportunity. Concerns a missed opportunity, and that is the Medicaid expansion, which would reach about 250,000 people yesterday with health coverage and also save about 700 lives a year.
All right. What about Medicaid expansion? Are you in accord with Governor Jindal on what he has done?
Well, as we stand right now, the answer is yes, because I think the whole future of Obamacare is very uncertain, and I think it's one of the worst pieces of legislation that has ever come out of the United States Congress, and I hope at some point we're going to step back from it, because I think it is an unwarranted imposition on the states to force the kind of coverage that they have. What I would do differently and what I will do differently, depending upon where things stand in a year and a half or really at the beginning of 2016 when things change, would be to sit down with people and look at whether or not a waiver for Louisiana is realistic, much what Arkansas and some other states did. And we ought to have that conversation. I've talked to legislators who've said we haven't really had that conversation about the pros and cons of what would happen. And is there a way to potentially avoid the pitfalls that Governor Jindal has talked about with a $1 billion bill being foisted upon the people of Louisiana down the road? A number of waivers have been given, and I think that discussion needs to take place because we are going to be responsible for uncompensated care costs for people who are not Medicaid eligible one way or the other. It's been one of the big hits on the budget, one of the big challenges we've had, and I think we need to have that discussion. It started out in a very political way, obviously, with Republican governors refusing to take the money at a time when they were hoping President Obama would be defeated and that Obamacare would be repealed. We're now in the second phase of this where the president was reelected. Obamacare is being implemented, though very poorly and with a lot of question marks and a lot of uncertainty. And it's hard to say where we're going to be a year and a half from now. But I think we need to continue having that discussion because Louisianians are going to have to pay for uncompensated care for people who aren't Medicaid eligible, and it's a very big chunk of our state budget.
We're about to go to a break, but you mentioned money, and you may not have as much as others who are running for governor. How much will it take? What amount of viable campaign?
Well, who knows? I mean, it'll take whatever it is I can raise. I've never borrowed money to run for political office. I don't have the independent wealth to put up money on my own, but I've been very fortunate to have a lot of people in Louisiana believe in me and contribute over the course of four campaigns in the last 7 years.
$5 million?
$5 million is certainly a reasonable number to expect what it will cost.
Or higher. 297-5633 is your number. We'll be back. It's been a bit more time with Jay Darden, the Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana, back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Jay Darden's the guest, the Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana, the pride of Baton Rouge High, Louisiana State University. And before we go back to the phone lines, and your number is 297-5633, we did get an inquiry of something that's been discussed here in the past. You're a graduate of LSU, and quite often the Old War School fares better when graduates are governors. Is there a direct correlation?
Well, I don't know. I can't compare, I guess, governors who have been graduates of LSU, but I've been very devoted to LSU my entire life, and I recognize its value from an economic standpoint to the state and what it means to Louisiana, and I want to see LSU succeed at the highest possible level, and they're going to do well if I have the opportunity to be governor, and higher education will do well.
297-5633 is your number. Here's a question posed by Kirsten at the Democratic Party. I think this is Kirsten Alvanataka. She says, would like to enlighten the Lieutenant Governor that the conversation he says isn't happening actually is. Senator Nevers' proposal would do just what the Lieutenant Governor suggests, a la the Arkansas plan. Will you support the Nevers proposal?
Well, I don't know what the Nevers proposal is, and as I said, I would want to have some discussion about this, and I think it absolutely is going to happen during this session. It didn't happen as much last year because it was more of a philosophical divide, and I think you're going to see particular pieces of legislation rather than just amendments, and that's going to provoke some discussion and let some people come to the table and talk about what could be possible.
What about this session? What do you think is going to happen? Governors quite often in their second terms late become, they're obviously lame ducks, and this governor is he's got his eye on something else, so is much going to happen in this session?
Well, he does have his eye on something else, and if it happens, it'll be as a result of legislative initiative. It doesn't look like there's a large agenda, and there hasn't been a lot of discussion about what will be on the table, and we're just a couple of weeks off from the session. It's the last general session for the folks who are serving now in this legislature, so the folks who are term-limited, it's their last real bite at the apple for a general session. Next year will be with the so-called tax-only session where you can file a few bills that will provoke some potential discussion. I would imagine that will be very lively and interesting next year in an election year. But I don't know that you're going to see a lot of major initiatives coming out of the legislature, but you'll see an awful lot of bills and an awful lot of ideas being discussed.
Thomas on Lee Drive. Thomas, you're on with Lieutenant Governor Darden.
Good morning, Jay and Jim.
Good morning.
I'm an independent, and I'm very enthusiastic about Jay's candidacy, and I wanted to ask him about his tenure in charge of the museums and recreation and tourism and where we might be going in this area. We've got a great resource down here, and I think Jay has done a good job when he worked in that area, and I'd appreciate his comments along that line.
Well, we're still working hard in that area, and I'm going to continue to do so for the next for the duration of my term, which will end at the end of next year. And we've had some great success. We've tried to build this Department of Culture, Recreation, and Tourism in a unified way, where everything that we're dealing with is promoting everything else. Happy to report that we were named the Southeast Tourism Office of the Year last year, the first time Louisiana has ever gotten that commendation. We just became the second state in America to gain certification from the Destination Marketing Association, which is kind of like the Good Housekeeping seal of approval for a tourism office in terms of how they manage their budget, how they deliver their message, and overall management. So we've certainly been committed to try and share the great things that Louisiana has to offer with people outside of Louisiana, and it's working. We're anxiously awaiting our 2013 numbers. We think they're going to be very positive, and I'm very optimistic about where we'll be this year and next year with a lot of initiatives we're putting forth to bring people to Louisiana, particularly from out of the country, international visitors who stay longer and spend more money. And we've put a renewed emphasis on that, and I think it's going to pay dividends. You know, in 2012, we were able to realize $665 million in revenue from visitors to Louisiana. That's taxes that I didn't pay and Louisianians didn't pay that helped with our health care needs, our education needs, our public safety needs. And so I constantly talk about tourism being big business for the state, and it's a major contributor to jobs and to the economy.
Charles downtown. Charles, you're on the air with Jay Darden. Hi, Charles. Charles, are you there? Okay. Let's try HB in Denham Springs. HB, you're on the air with Jay Darden. Hi, HB.
Good morning, gentlemen. Lieutenant Governor, you are probably one of the most experienced political people that there is with your vast experience in the legislature and things like that. My question is this. I've once heard Mitch Landrieu on the steps of the Capitol say that, and it's been in the news media quite heavily here and since all the candidates have announced that they're going to run for governor, that it takes 3 to 5 years for a good bill to make it through the legislative process, but a bad bill can go through immediately. My question is, how can you change this in a 4-year period or even an 8-year period to the progression of education that we need to go? Thank you, sir.
Well, it doesn't necessarily always take that long for a good bill to pass, and I think it is correct that sometimes a bad bill can slip by pretty quickly, but there are an awful lot of bad bills that have been in the hopper for a long time and that eventually wind up becoming law. I don't know that you can change the dynamics of the legislative process. It is a marketplace for ideas in the legislature, and people bring ideas, and some of them are very good, and some of them pass quickly. Some of them need a little more time to germinate. I don't know that I can tell you that you're going to change the process one way or the other real quickly. I think you have to be strongly involved in the process as a governor in advocating for what you believe needs to happen. And that certainly will happen if I'm there.
Here's a question from Kyle. He says, Louisiana incarcerates a higher percentage of its citizens than any other state. As governor, what would you, Jay Darden, do to decrease the prison population of our state?
Well, you have to start by attacking crime on the front end and trying to make sure you're preventing the commission of crime so that you don't have more people being incarcerated. We do have the highest incarceration rate in America, and that's very frustrating, and it's very costly. And I think you're starting to see some meaningful discussion, and we had it when I was in the legislature, about what kind of programs can be implemented to stop criminal behavior at a young age so that they're not going to be going to Angola and other major prisons, and also to look at the sentencing provisions that are in Louisiana law so that you're not going to be putting away someone for an inordinate period of time whose crime, relatively speaking, is not as severe as the folks who you want put away for a long time. So you'll see some discussion about that during the course of this legislative session, obviously, and it's going to be an ongoing discussion because it is one of the huge drains on Louisiana's budget, what it costs to incarcerate people in our state.
Nicholas on Nicholson writes, the Louisiana lawmakers have rejected the proposition of equal pay for the same work for women and men. What is Mr. Darden's position on this subject?
Well, I certainly believe that women deserve the same level of pay that men do. And I don't know that the state needs to be in the business of mandating those type of provisions in the private sector. But I think the so-called glass ceiling that existed in the past has clearly been broken. And I think there are going to be greater opportunities in the future for women. I don't know that government needs to be the one to mandate that, though, particularly in the private sector.
297-5633 for Jay Darden. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on the air with Jay Darden, the Lieutenant Governor.
Yes. If elected, will you continue shielding the communication of the governor's office from public view under the guise of economic development?
No, I won't. And it's been interesting that a lot of the changes that have been made in ethics laws and disclosure laws that apply to the legislature, for example, are not applicable to the executive branch as well. I was involved in a lot of legislation dealing with economic development when I was in the Senate, and this was always a very delicate subject. You have to be careful when you're courting businesses and when you're making some levels of commitment to be respectful of their desire not to have everything public during the course of the courtship, if you will. But I certainly believe there needs to be a greater level of disclosure, and I was supportive of what Senator Adley has been trying to do regarding executive branch disclosure, and I'm gonna take that same guise if I'm fortunate enough to have the office.
Question from Victor, but what about the super PACs? Senator Vitter wants to employ them in his campaign and actually get the limits changed from $100,000, which is a state law. What do you think of these operatives in the political process?
Well, it's a huge concern, and Louisianians ought to pay attention to this and be very concerned about the huge levels of money that are going to be spent and are attempting to be spent. And Senator Vitter is actually gone to court to try and say he wants people to be able to give more than what Louisiana state law allows, and I think that's a major problem and a major concern, and I don't want Washington politics further invested in Louisiana. We see enough of that already, and we need to move in exactly the opposite direction. So I think I certainly have some concerns about super PACs, particularly when they're controlled by the person who's benefiting from them, and I believe that's what's happening now.
Jay in Mid-City. Jay, you're on the air with Jay Darden.
Good morning. I like Mr. Darden, as an African-American, I don't see no one in the governor's race that I can surely support right now, because I don't think no one in any race have a relationship with the black community. And what are your ideas of, to approach the black community to get out and vote? And how?
You know, I've been very involved with the African-American community throughout the state in my role as Secretary of State and as Lieutenant Governor in creating opportunities and opening museums and advancing a trail that already existed in the Lieutenant Governor's office and trying to enhance that. I view African-American voters like I view other voters. I want them to look at me and make a determination of what qualities I have to offer and what they think a leader ought to be about. So I'm going to approach that community the same way I approach any community, and I hope that the days of African-Americans saying they just can't vote for a Republican in Louisiana are gone.
David at White Oak Landing. Hi, David. You're on with Jay Darden.
Hey, Jay. It's good to talk to you again. I'm sorry to hear about your basketball career ending.
Yeah.
I used to play with you years and years ago back at the Acadian Club.
Remember those days.
Yes. On your subject of crime, if there had been back then and now a lot more Acadian Club-type places around the city and the state, I think we would have a lot less problems with crime. Those are the types of institutions I think we need to keep the kids off the street and keep them involved in things, and I'd like to see more of that developed in the future. I don't know, as a governor, what you could do for that, but...
Well, a lot of communities are creating local efforts like that, and organizations like the Boys Club and the Girls Club and others that are providing recreation alternatives and artistic alternatives. And let me just say a little something about that, because music education, art education is something that I've been feel very strongly about. It, kids do better on standardized scores when they have those opportunities, and you have to find the creative sense that exists among children and try and tap into it and point them in the right direction. And I think arts and music programs, athletic programs are a great way of doing that. It happens a great deal in the private sector, and I think that ought to be encouraged, and there are limits on what government can do, but a number of communities have created midnight basketball programs, other type of athletic opportunities like that to try and get kids pointed in a positive direction.
Lukata, I think that's correct, in Zion City. Good morning. You're on with Jay Darden.
How you doing? I just wanted to get an idea on your feelings about legalizing medical marijuana in Louisiana.
Well, I'm going to listen to that debate very carefully. I've thought about that, how I would view that in the legislature, and I would want to listen to what people say about it. But my feeling going in is that I don't think we ought to be legalizing marijuana in Louisiana. If there's some type of limited usage, it could be directed from a medical standpoint. We ought to look at that, and I would be open to look at it. But my gut feeling on it, without listening to testimony and seeing a lot of data, because it's not something I've investigated a lot yet, is that I don't want to go in that direction.
All right. Charles in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Charles. You're on with Governor Darden.
Yes. I'm just off of Jefferson Highway. You got off of Jefferson Highway at Blue Bonnet, and our streets all over town are in terrible shape. So, you know, that's a perennial problem. What would you do about something like that? And secondly, I think you live in the St. George area, whether you do or not. I was wondering what your take is on incorporating that area as a city.
Well, first of all, on the streets, you know, you may have seen lately that The city is looking at taking over some of the state highways because they can do a quicker and better job of repairing them, and that's I think that's probably a very good thing. There's no magic bullet for fixing state highways in Louisiana, though. I mean, there's a limited amount of money that's dedicated for that purpose. It's an ongoing challenge, and we need to be very cognizant of that. I don't live in the St. George area. Actually, I'm right on the boundary, so I'm in the city limit, so I don't have a vote on that matter. My feeling is that I don't know that the answer to bad government is more government, and that's one of the first things that popped up in my mind with the whole movement started. But I also believe in the self-determination for people. I don't think I have enough information right now, or the public has enough information right now, to understand the full financial implication of what would happen if St. George became a city. And that would be my primary concern if I were in the district, and again, I'm not, as to what my tax bill is going to look like to create a city and to provide the infrastructure that's needed for a city, to provide whatever legacy costs may be owed, and some may very well be, to the city of Baton Rouge. So there's a lot of uncertainty right now. I think the public needs a lot more information. I certainly do, before I could tell you that I think it's going to be a great deal for the people who live in the St. George area.
Here's a question from Ari. Is a candidate's personal integrity an issue in the governor's race?
Well, sure. It ought to be an issue in any election of a public official, and I think that ought to be. It's certainly something that I've talked about during the course of my political career, and I hope the public looks at as they evaluate candidates.
Senator Vitter, as we know, has had problems. He acknowledged it in 2007. He consorted with prostitutes. Is that an issue in 2015?
Well, voters will decide whether it's an issue or not.
Will you bring it up?
I don't intend to bring it up. I think it's very well known by people, and it won't be a part of what I do in my campaign.
But it is the elephant in the room.
It is, and it's going to be out there, and everybody's going to have to deal with it.
Well, it's something in politics. People say they don't like negative campaigning, but quite often it works.
Well, that's always what you hear. Nobody seems to like it. Consultants constantly tell you it works. I've certainly been victimized by it in a number of my campaigns.
Including the last one.
And had to deal with it. It's what happens, and you hope that people will ferret out the truth and recognize that it's very easy for people to say whatever it is they want to say about somebody. But I've certainly been around long enough that people have been able to observe me and observe my conduct and make a determination if I'm the kind of guy they want to keep in public life.
Here's a good question from Sam. What about debates next year? Will you welcome debates of all the candidates, or will you try to limit that?
No, sure. I love an opportunity to talk and to debate and to discuss issues, and I certainly intend to be involved in that. I mean, it's interesting, because it's very early for us to even be talking about what's going to happen next year. We've got elections this fall, but I think and I hope that the whole debate will begin once we complete the cycle this fall.
Barry in Mid-City, you've got 15 seconds for Jay Darden. Hi, Barry.
Hey, good morning, Jay. Wonderful memories of your father taking tickets over at the baseball stadium.
Yeah, I think of him often.
May he rest. And your dedication to the state would certainly speak well. Your vision of government for Louisiana?
All right. That's Rabbi Weinstein, and I don't want to cut to Jay Darden short, and he's short on time, so we'll bring him back, and we'll let him answer Rabbi Weinstein's question, and then we'll let him get on his way and do what he does as lieutenant governor. Back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF. In Baton Rouge. Jay Darden's in overtime. The lieutenant governor has another appointment, but he did stay. He wanted to answer Rabbi Weinstein's question about the vision. Do you have a vision for our state as governor?
Well, I think he was asking about the vision of what government would look like, and I would say it really ought to run like a nonprofit in this sense. It ought not to be worried about making a profit for government itself. It ought to keep its overhead low and provide the services that need to be provided by the people in the most expeditious and responsible way possible. Not to say you're giving away or caring for people like nonprofits do, but you would have a mindset as a chief executive that I want to do this like a nonprofit would do it.
Okay. Well, good luck. Let's talk soon.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Jay Darden. Speaking of nonprofits, we have an expert on them in studio now, taking the place of the Lieutenant Governor, Erica Crenshaw, former Wall Street equity research analyst with about two decades of financial experience. She left the leading global investment bank Goldman Sachs in 2002 and has been in Baton Rouge now for how long?
For 5 years.
As president and CEO of Execute Now. She has a column in the current issue of the Baton Rouge Business Report about nonprofit challenges. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What are the biggest challenges right now?
Wow. Well, I think the biggest challenge is the business model of nonprofits. And Jay Darden just mentioned that government should run like a nonprofit. I agree that, yes, there should certainly be low overhead. But I am always encouraging nonprofits to look to the corporate sector as from a financial business model. So I think that is one of the biggest challenges of nonprofits is from the financial standpoint.
297-5633 is your number. Erica Crenshaw, the president and CEO of Execute Now, which is involved with many of the leading nonprofits in our community and around the state. And you say nonprofits should have a business plan. Well, I work in mostly the for-profit world, but I've also been in the nonprofit world, and the goals are somewhat different, maybe a lot different. So how do you square those two objectives?
Well, I would differ. I think the goals from a financial standpoint are quite the same. I always say that the difference in a nonprofit is really the tax status. No, they aren't in the business of actually making a profit, but they are in the business of transforming lives and making certain that they have a sustainable model. So in order for that to happen, which is obviously similar to for-profit, you have to make certain that you have not just a strategic plan and a business plan, but one that's aligned with the finances. And if there's a misalignment between the finances of the organization, or if the finances aren't as complex as the business model of the organization, then there's a misalignment. And that nonprofit can't move forward in a sustainable way and really make the impacts that they want to make in the community.
Well, what should be in a business plan for a nonprofit?
All right. So it's more than just a business plan. So there are a couple of things. So one, there needs to be a strategic vision for the organization, and looking beyond just the first year, but looking at the second and third year as well. So whatever the mission is of the organization, they need to needs to be something that's thoughtful, something that's tweaked throughout the year, not just something that they look at once a year when the board members and the leaders of the organization sit together for 4 hours or so and kind of hash out a plan. But it's something that needs to be monitored really on a quarterly basis to make certain that the goals are being met in the organization and that there aren't any surprises at the end of the year.
Well, you got to pay your bills whether you're in a private business or a public one.
That's
and,
right.
And that has to be the first objective. And we've seen some nonprofits go by the wayside.
Absolutely.
And maybe it's because they didn't have a strategic plan.
Well, they didn't have a strategic plan, but they also didn't have a strategic finance department, if you will. Many nonprofits fall or fail because they lack the strategic understanding of their organization from a financial standpoint. Hull House, I always talk about Hull House in Chicago that serves 60,000 individuals throughout throughout Chicago, and they failed. I mean, they had a peak operating budget of about $45 million, and they fell by the wayside just because the complexity of their finances didn't change with the complexity of their organization. And it lacked CFO or just kind of financial oversight. There wasn't any thorough analysis of the organization. Simply dotting I's and crossing T's just really isn't good enough for nonprofits that really want to make a true impact in the community.
We're visiting with Erica Crenshaw, president and CEO of Execute Now, former Wall Street equity research analyst. How many years were you in New York?
Gosh, I was in New York for 8 years,
eight or nine years.
Yes.
Worked with Deutsche Bank, Citibank, Prudential, Capital Group. What are the biggest distinctions between the for-profit world and the nonprofit environment?
I think the biggest distinction is the fact that nonprofit executives need to, there is a mindset that they're doing such good work that someone should give them a handout, if you will, because they look at themselves as a charity versus paying for being funded based on the impact that they make in the community, based on the results. In the for-profit world, we expect to get paid based on results. If we don't provide results, we expect not to get paid. It's just as simple as that, where I think the mindset is different between for-profit and nonprofit leaders.
You write in your business report column that one of the nation's leading experts on social impact, Jason Saul, talks about how nonprofits have to stop, quote, begging for charity and start selling impact.
That's right.
And in impact, you mean results.
Results, correct.
And most nonprofits do good work for the community, so the impact can be substantial.
The impact can be substantial if it's measured, and that's the biggest challenge that nonprofits and funders face as well. There needs to be measured impact. So you say that you are mentoring 100 kids, and you say your goal is to make certain that those students don't get expelled from school or that they aren't going to prison. And I say that my organization does the exact same thing, but only 75% of my kids actually meet that goal. So I would dare say that you should get funded at a higher rate and receive a lot more funding than my nonprofit, just because I only 75% of my kids only reach that goal.
All right. What's the biggest difference between the pace in New York City and in Baton Rouge, where you've been for 5 years?
Well, there's a big difference in the pace, but I've lived in so many different places around the world that it wasn't a shock for me moving to or living in Baton Rouge. And quite frankly, Baton Rouge was a lot more progressive than I thought it would be. This is actually my first time spending a substantial amount of time in the South and living and working in the community. But it's been a pleasure.
Weren't you in Maryland? That's the South, isn't it?
Well, I'm from Maryland. I am from Maryland, but there are definitely some Southern roots there, obviously. But being from the D.C. metropolitan area, we try to act like big city folks.
All right. Well, you say Baton Rouge is more progressive than you envisioned. How so?
I think the community is a lot more welcoming to outside ideas and just new and fresh blood coming into the community. You get the sense when you're in any small town southern community that is so insular that any new ideas won't be well received. And it's been a challenge in some respects, but overall, it's been refreshing and again a lot more progressive than I originally thought.
Well, your firm, I know, is involved in the not so sexy accounting aspect of nonprofits and for profits. And how does that differ from one to the other as far as balancing the books? In one that is literally a nonprofit, not designed to make money, and another that's designed to make as much money as you can.
Sure. Well, our strategic value, Jim, really isn't the back office or the accounting. It really is the CFO level strategic services. And that's what really gets me excited. And that's the reason that we revamped Execute Now's business model to do just that, to make certain that CEOs thoroughly understand the operations of their organization and that we're analyzing the accounting. So we're analyzing the numbers on a monthly basis, on a quarterly basis, and really working in lockstep with the CEO to make certain that there's that alignment and whatever goals that they want to achieve to make certain that those goals are achieved.
It's important to have good numbers, real numbers, rather than numbers that come out of the sky somewhere. Yesterday we had Matt Williams on here talking about Nielsen ratings and how careers live and die and fortunes are built on Nielsen ratings. Well, the accounting numbers have to be backed up with
legitimacy. Oh, sure. There has to be support. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you were in China for a while as well. That was between New York and Baton Rouge or before New York?
No, that was before New York.
Before New York.
Yes.
So you talk about embracing new cultures. You went all the way to China. How long were you there?
I was in China for a year.
For a year. And how was that experience?
It was wonderful. It was amazing. I love the Chinese culture. My daughter studied Chinese and a couple of the languages, and I just embrace new cultures. There's so much to learn from people from different walks of life and just different cultures in general. So I am a Chinese enthusiast, and I just love the culture, the food. People call me a Chinese person in a black body, or black on the outside but Chinese inside. I'm a tiger mom, and you know, I'm it all when it comes to. I love China and the culture, absolutely.
What part were you in?
I was in Shanghai, but I went around
big cities.
Yeah, but I went around to some of the smaller cities too, in the rural areas as well. I probably visited, I don't know, maybe a half a dozen cities throughout China.
And you learned the language,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think that's the easiest language to learn, but when you're in the culture, you got to learn it or get out, I would think.
That's right. You have to learn it to survive. And it actually is a lot easier than some Romance languages, at least I think.
Well, that ability to adapt probably has helped you immensely in your moves to New York, now to Baton Rouge,
yes.
and anywhere else you're going.
That's right. That's right.
You plan on being here for a while, though, right?
We do plan on being here for a while. As long as the community would have us, we'll be here.
Well, and Erica has been featured in places like Essence Magazine, right?
Yes.
What was that about?
That was when I owned the franchises. So we owned five franchises, bought those franchises after I left Goldman Sachs. And so I was featured in Essence because I became one of the top producers within about 5 years in the franchise system.
Well, you have some varied background. That's not an easy world, is it?
No, but, you know, I'm gravitated towards male-dominated environments and industries, it seems like. It's not easy. I had a lot of engineers on staff. Everyone on my staff was older than me. I was 25, 26 years mm-hmm. old. I think the youngest person was my assistant. So not easy, but challenging. And I learned a lot about leadership, mm-hmm. which is critical in any organization or company that you may run.
Here's a question from Heather about companies and their cultures. Is it essential that a company have a mission statement?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Central that you have a mission statement, and it's essential that you have a culture that feeds your mission statement and that your employees really understand the mission statement. There's a good friend of mine who was a former president of a hospital, and she would go around and give $100 to everyone who could recite the mission statement. So I think that's very important.
I remember one business person told me once his business or his mission statement was make money and have fun. I think I could remember that one.
That's easy to remember.
But some of them are several pages long. How long should a mission statement be?
Well, you know, a mission statement certainly shouldn't be several pages long, no. And it's a mission statement. Everyone needs to come together and have an understanding of the mission statement so that it's something that that they can articulate, but also something that they believe as well. So several pages long is obviously too mm-hmm. long for anyone.
Nonprofits constantly talk about values. What do they generally mean when they're discussing values in their mission statement?
Well, it depends on the nonprofit, but values is really how they value the community and how they value their constituents. And nonprofits actually have, and just like any organization, we all have different constituents that we have to value in different ways. So our constituents are our clients, our employees, and our stakeholders. And your depending on your nonprofit, your constituents could be different and you could value them differently as well.
Charlotte in New Iberia. Charlotte, you're on the air with Erica Crenshaw, who is president and CEO of mm-hmm. Execute Now. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi. Would your guest please tell us what are the industries that represent her five franchises?
The franchises that you were involved with.
Sure. The franchise, the parent company is ServiceMaster, which used to trade on the New York Stock Exchange. The company or the franchises that we owned were Amerispec. Our sister company is Terminex, and we conducted residential, commercial, and environmental inspections.
Yeah, so most people, when they think of franchises, they're probably thinking of like fast food places. But
most of them do, yes. Their margins are so small at restaurants, so we steer clear of those.
Well, if somebody wants to get into franchising, how do you crack the door?
Research. Yeah, you have to do a lot of research. I would research the company from a top-down approach to understand the stability of the parent company, and then talk with franchise owners around the country about their model and what works best for them. And the model may be the same, but communities are different, so you have to really understand mm-hmm. the community that you're in to make certain that the franchise that you decide to purchase actually bodes well in that community and would work well in that community. So you have to do a tremendous amount of research and financial modeling as well.
We're short on time, but I know you also were involved in the startup of a charter school in New Orleans. How did that go?
It worked well when I was there. Unfortunately, it recently closed. I think it was last year I got a notice that it closed. But the idea was to make certain that they were on a strong financial footing, and that was the objective. They ended the year with about a 2-3% margin, which is unheard of in the charter school space.
Well, we thank you for joining us. Second time for Erica Crenshaw. Hopefully we'll have you back again.
Thanks so much, Jim.
Take care. Good to talk with you, and we shall return tomorrow. Until then, for Michael Farrar producing today, I'm Jim Inkster. We thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.